Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Cities all over the world are taking the lead on responding to climate change, but there is a lack of funding at the local level to implement the types of renewable energy and energy efficiency projects that could meaningfully reduce greenhouse gas emissions while creating family wage jobs. Now Portlanders are getting together to pass the Portland Clean Energy Fund next fall, an initiative that will create and fund the city's own clean energy future. Today we talk with Carrie Waters and Maggie Talmadge, two leaders within the campaign to put the Portland Clean Energy Fund on the city ballot this November. Carrie is the Community Engagement Manager at the Native American Youth and Family Center, and Maggie is the Environmental Justice Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color. Maggie and Carrie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, before we start talking about the actual initiative that's going to be on the ballot, let's talk a little bit about the, the social and economic and maybe cultural and race divide between those who the haves and the have-nots in the whole climate change discussion.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So I think I would start back by talking about environmental racism. Historically in this country, not unique to Portland, communities of color, low-income communities have been used as the dumping grounds for waste incinerators, for industry, for highways and high traffic corridors. So environmental justice is the idea that we're going to revert that, right? So even in Portland, again, our communities are often the ones that receive the bad things. And we're last to receive the good things, the environmental investments, bike lanes, bioswales, trees even.
Parks.
Yeah, one example, right, is the Coley neighborhood, one of the most diverse neighborhoods in this city, in the state, and is actually 9 degrees warmer than the rest of the city simply because there's no tree canopy and it's surrounded by industry. And then we look again to the Jade District out in Southeast, around Southeast 82nd, and you see higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of asthma, because these diverse communities are surrounded by high traffic corridors. And then couple that the fact that, you know, our communities are first to receive the bad and the last to receive the good investments, the last to receive investments from the sustainability movement in our institutions, in our neighborhoods. We're also the last to be consulted, typically, right? We have not been at the decision-making table. These decisions are made by someone else for our communities. And this really extends, again, to the sustainability movement, to the environmental movement, to the clean energy movement, and that our communities are last to see job opportunities, job training opportunities. And it also creates an additional burden and risk of climate change. If a family is, let's take, for example, the fires we had last summer. What if you have no air conditioning? What if you cannot afford air conditioning? It's 100 degrees outside. It's sweltering in your house, but you're unable to open the windows because there's particulate matter in the air. So there's both a disproportionate burden of climate change in the means of an inability to adapt. And then there's a disproportionate lack of access to mitigate climate change as well.
Well, I think that we were talking just before we went on the air about how much Portland has changed in the last 10 years. It's changed a lot over the last 100 as well. But one of the things that is notable to me is that while Portland increases its international celebrity as being this incredibly green, progressive, sustainable city, that the contradictions within seem to be heightening. Because, as Carrie and I were talking before we went on the air, it's only been in the last 10 years or so that I've seen a lot of rich people move to Portland. And I think maybe redefine it. They've come here for all the good reasons, but they don't get it. And one of the things they don't get is they don't see outside of the Pearl District, downtown Northwest, and maybe some parts of close in Southeast and Northeast Portland. So how do we counter that? Because I think that there, if you went back historically to throughout Portland's history, you would see a huge amount of racial and class divide. And there's always been a lot of gnarly stuff in our history. But there seemed to be, in my mind, a sense that we were moving forward to a certain point, and now we've taken a really funny turn. I'm wondering how you see this, Carrie, because you grew up here, right?
Yes, I grew up here in the Portland metro area, and seeing the huge changes that had happened once I came back about 10 years ago from college was just incredibly jarring. You know, it was exciting on the one hand to see development and attention on Portland, and on the other hand, attention and development for whom and by whom. So, one of the conversations that we've been having a lot throughout Portland Clean Energy Fund and some of these other circles and conversations is related to redefining anti-displacement as a pillar of climate resilience, because we know that oftentimes people are forced to pay rent or to pay for their food. The utility burden is so huge. And so we need to talk about all of these interconnected issues as one in the same.
And the other thing that I'm seeing is I know a lot of people who would have probably been considered middle class, mostly white people who had a very comfortable life in Portland, who are not homeowners. So they were renting either apartments or nice little houses in the east side. And they're all getting thrown out of their houses and apartments, and their apartments and houses are being torn down to put up these huge structures that cost $2,000 for a one-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. So there seems to be a commonality. It's like becoming more of a cross-sectional effect of people who are being impacted by this. So it's no longer just like a race issue or even like a class issue, because unless you are very wealthy, I mean, this is the fear, that you're not going to be able to live very decently in Portland.
Well, it's a similar narrative as what happened with, the Bullseye Glass Company and all of the air quality issues that arose over the past couple of years. Our dominant society doesn't recognize these as issues until they're happening to white dominant society.
So that may be a help, but it's also, I'm wondering if it also is a diversion. Mm. What do you think, Maggie?
I think, as a coalition of communities of color, we do center race. And the way we, and personally, I think about addressing policy is to center those most marginalized, who have been most left out, again, of decision-making, of wealth-building opportunities, excluded from neighborhoods, as we've seen in Portland and in Oregon, or, in the case of Oregon, wholly excluded from the state because of the color of their skin. So I think about something that John Powell, who taught at Lewis and Clark, he talked about targeted universalism, and that, we think about universal strategies as policies or policy interventions to address and build towards universal goals. However, with targeted universalism, we take those communities that face the most barriers, those individuals that face the most barriers, whether because of institutions and systematic policies. We take the most marginalized, most underserved, and we center policies to move them towards that universal goal. And we measure progress that way. Another way I think about targeted universalism is we are expanding the stakes of a tent. The further you bring those stakes out from a tent, the more people you're going to cover. So that's the approach we take. And I wholly believe that whether we're talking about housing, displacement, climate change, the environmental movement, we need to center those most marginalized, most underserved, and who have been left out of decision making.
Well, another attack that's often made on the environmental movement from the right is that it's a white elitist upper middle class movement for people who have the money to put on the solar panels, to to live in a place like Portland to begin with, to drive that electric car, to do all these things that cost a lot of money. And there are programs in Oregon and around the country to try to help people in low-income communities to be able to achieve some of those same goals. I'm just wondering, how genuine do you think those programs are? How valid is the criticism from the right that the environmental movement is a white elitist movement?
Well, I think I'd also go back to the fact that our communities, communities of color, vote above and beyond the rate, or vote for environmental and climate initiatives above and beyond the rate of white voters. So it's simply not true that our communities don't care about the environment or the climate. Maybe we're not at a certain environmental organization, but we certainly hold those values.
And our communities, you know, by necessity have to take the bus because they're transit dependent, or are carrying their canvas shopping bags because that's most practical for them, walking and riding the bus. And so we have to look at these issues from a systems change perspective, because so many of those folks who are transit dependent are now getting pushed farther and farther out to the outskirts of our region and are having to live in places that are more isolated, that don't have good transit access. And so we're leaving our community members behind.
Well, one of the really disturbing things to watch in Portland and in cities around the country is that there are these historic cultural communities, and they are disappearing. I mean, the two that I think of, actually, it was kind of fascinating and disturbing to watch Chinatown in Portland, which was always very small, move to 82nd Street and get dispersed. And now it's really, there's no like Chinese community so much as this is kind of pan-Asian community. It's also, some of it's a function of being second and third and fourth generation immigrants now, so that the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are further away from their original cultural roots. But perhaps the most disturbing thing to be watching is what's been going on in North Portland for maybe 25 years or more. Maybe beginning with the gentrification of Alberta Street and then just moving the gentrification to Mississippi. And now it's Williams Avenue. And I actually just drove down Vancouver the other day and see that those Williams Avenue style buildings are now going up on Vancouver. So communities that had it very tightly knit, you just can't move that tightly knit community out to Gresham or wherever they're supposed to move now to. So I'm wondering what can be done to try to put a stop on that kind of displacement and find ways to maintain communities here in the inner city?
I think first off, it's recognizing the city, the states, this nation's history of exploitation and extraction of labor and capital from people of color. We can look back at the state's history. Oregon's exclusion law kept African Americans out of the state. It was finally repealed in 1854, but replaced by similar language, and much of which remained till 2000. The reason why we have communities in such tightly knit communities is because that's the only place they were allowed to live. African Americans and many other communities were prevented from accessing mortgages, prevented from accessing capital. And we know very well that there was a huge impetus for white families to access very cheap credit, to buy homes, to accumulate wealth. And that hasn't been the case for communities of color, and particularly African Americans in the region. So I would start first looking at that history. The Coalition of Communities of Color put out a report last year called A Cross-Cultural Agenda to Prevent Displacement and Gentrification. And it was in partnership with the Urban League of Portland, along with a number of our member organizations, and really detailed this history a lot of that gentrification in Alberta, Williams area, and some potential areas to intervene.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Maggie Tomlinch, who you just heard, and Carrie Waters, who are two leaders within the campaign to put the Portland Clean Energy Fund on the ballot this November, which we're about to talk to. Before we get to what we can do specifically with this ballot initiative, I'm thinking about the role models that Portland has to not be, and the two that really pop up are Seattle and San Francisco. And last fall, I was in San Francisco probably for the first time in a couple of years, and I was in the Mission District, a neighborhood that I had very strong feelings for and used to live right near. And I was very disturbed to see, actually, the part of the Mission I was in was not the gentrified part of the Mission. It was the homeless part of the Mission. And I kind of left my time in San Francisco that day thinking, San Francisco's turned into a city of the very rich and the homeless. What, I mean, when we look at these stark places, because there is the thing that on the one hand, some of these neighborhoods get gentrified, but the parts that are getting left behind are not being served at all. And the Mission, it's the first time I was ever in the Mission, and it was, part of it was kind of scary because people are so desperate. So how do we not, I mean, do you think Portland is already getting, moving on the, in that direction, and how do we turn the train around?
We have to have an explicit conversation about our definition of success. So as Maggie mentioned, we have to be able to air out our dirty laundry as a nation and look at the very beginnings of the extraction of natural resources, the exploitation of people of color, the genocide of our indigenous populations. And we have to, you know, do some soul searching as a society to think through how we define success, because our dominant society defines it as concentration of wealth and power. And we see that in the housing market, as we were just discussing, you know, which is a profitable industry for folks in the real estate market, as well as landlords. Whereas we see many of our communities living in intergenerational housing by choice because they want to be there together and to take care of each other. And so we need to move towards this definition of success as social and ecological well-being. And we need to have that conversation explicitly, because so often things can get muddied by this larger dominant narrative that's being pushed at us every single day through advertising and other channels.
Well, I just wonder, do you think there's any way to put the brakes on what's going on right now in North Portland and to preserve what's left of it for the communities that has lived there historically for, well, since World War II?
Well, I think one of the issues, too, is we need to recognize that and stop thinking that gentrification and displacement is inevitable, is simply a force of capitalism. We need to think, why do we believe, why do many of us just believe in this this free wielding hand as the force that drives our community? And we need to think about community capacitation, ensuring that our communities are ready to engage and advocate for themselves. Things like community benefit agreements and zones, so that the community is actually having a conversation with a developer and ensuring that, you know, there's jobs produced, that there's an assurance that there will be affordable units included. Requiring public processes to be more public, ensuring that, you know, planning and zoning is more accessible to community, both in terms of how it's talked about, as well as transportation to those meetings, having them at a reasonable hours where families with children and childcare can attend, providing food, providing childcare, supporting culturally specific institutions. A number of our members actually develop affordable housing and specifically focus on, try to focus on communities of color that have been displaced, that have, you know, seen their communities pulled apart because of gentrification. So it's supporting and investing in those institutions, which are woefully underfunded compared to many mainstream environmental and housing institutions.
Well, I'm wondering, how do you maintain, how do you assure that there's going to be affordable housing in a neighborhood like Albina, which is just seeing this runaway gentrification? What is it possible to put the brakes on this and to sort of turn things in a different direction? And is part of that the plan of the this initiative that you're working on right now to kind of change the conversation and then also change the action plan?
I would say yes, absolutely. And we need multiple solutions. You know, there's no silver bullet to these problems. And, you know, in addition to Portland Clean Energy Fund, for example, last Wednesday, our Metro Regional Government Council referred the affordable housing bond to the November ballot. So that's coming up as well. And they shared in their report from their chief operating officer that they did some polling and had some conversations early on as they were considering a transportation bond and a parks bond. And overwhelmingly, our community across the region recognized that we have to address housing first. And we've recognized this through our engagement in projects like the Lentz Green Ring in the Lentz neighborhood, which is where NEA's affordable housing project Generations is sited.
And what does a green ring mean?
A green ring is a network to promote active transportation and community resources like the Lentz Park, the Malden Community Orchard, NEA Generations, and other resources. So it's a ring from Southeast 87th up Steele over 101st and down the Springwater Corridor that promotes walking, cycling, rolling, as well as green infrastructure and other community resources.
Well, I guess when I think about my ideal community, I'm thinking about Lentz, which has been interesting because I go through Lentz quite frequently, and it's been fascinating to watch it transform. And I'm watching what looks like creeping gentrification, which is like outrageous to me because Lentz has been historically one of the poorest neighborhoods in the Portland area. But I think about what I always loved about Lentz when I first moved to Portland, and part of it was kind of semi-rural. And if there's a way to build housing that's good housing stock, and it can be denser, I mean, and I think some people want to live in apartments, some people want to live in houses, so you have a diversity of housing, but you maintain, I mean, I hear this thing about orchards, you know, like you maintain some kind of farmland and you maintain natural spaces and wildlife habitat. Do you think that's a reality? Will you give me my fantasy?
Absolutely. I think so. And we've seen it in that context. There was another project that I worked on back in 2011 with the Tulalip tribes up north of Seattle for a neighborhood scale smart growth development near some very important areas with cultural and natural resources. And those community members also shared, we want our green space. Don't take away our green space and force us into these apartment complexes. But there's this recognition of opportunity of a variety of different types of housing that, you know, we have in some neighborhoods here in Portland, like the Buckman neighborhood, which we call middle housing, that middle between single family homes and these huge apartment buildings. And so people can still live in a dense space, but also have that access to those shared green spaces and open areas where they can garden and enjoy.
Well, Buckman's an interesting habitat. Neighborhood. I mean, until recently, every time I was in Buckman, I think, God, this hasn't changed since 1971. Now it's one of the most rapidly changing neighborhoods in Portland, aside from Williams Avenue.
It's the neighborhood that I got displaced from a couple of years back. And, you know, tying all of this together, our community across the region recognizes that we have to address affordable housing first because we need that infrastructure in place before we start developing all of these transportation improvements and parks and all of those investments that tend to then push people out.
Well, the other day I was at my mechanics and I was reading the Southeast Examiner, which was really, I mean, it's actually a very good neighborhood newspaper. I think it's the only one that's not owned by Pamplin. Mm-hmm. And it was reading about these city plans to basically to densify the city more and these kinds of zoning changes that would allow for basically multifamily buildings in what are now single-family zoned areas. And people were complaining, both in the actually, there was an article about it and then the letters, and talking about how this is really geared towards, first of all, putting all the density in low-income neighborhoods. So, like, the east side was going to be, like, really inflicted with it, and the west side was going to be off the hook. And that it was done by, one of the letter writers was blaming Charlie Hales. I like to blame for everything, so, even the good things he did. But anyway, I just wonder, you know, like, is that a concern? I mean, that this is, that while we're pushing density in the city, it's not happening in a very equitable way.
Well, I really think that we cannot equitably grow Portland without challenging existing land use laws and policies, which have historically and still are built on explicit racism. That we can't do this without challenging contracting and financing practices, which often favor large white institutions that have had access to capital for decades and centuries. We cannot do this without recognizing that, you know, free market economic thought doesn't view justice as a sound investment. We have to rethink all of those. And we need to realize too, and our electeds, our community members, our developers, everyone in the community needs to recognize that actually literature and research shows over and over again, inequality is bad for people. It's bad for economic growth. It's bad for wages. It's bad for the economy as a whole. And if we're thinking about housing as one of the greatest opportunities to build wealth, but also one of the biggest expenses for our communities, we can't, we've got to pull it all together, you know, and realize that, again, when investments are denied for our communities or delayed, and we rely on trickle-down equity, as I say, it's really justice denied.
Did you have any more thoughts about that, Carrie?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I'll let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Carrie Waters and Maggie Tomich, who are two leaders within the campaign to put the Portland Clean Energy Fund on the city ballot this November. So let's talk now about the Portland Clean Energy Fund, because we've been talking about what's wrong and what needs to be addressed. So what is the vision for using this Portland Clean Energy Fund as a way to create the world that Maggie was just describing?
The Portland Clean Energy Fund envisions a city in which our big business retail corporations that make over $1 billion nationally and over $500,000 locally will start to pay their fair share for their ecological and social impact through a meager 1% surcharge on their in Portland revenue that would generate over $30 million per year and would be fed into a fund administered by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, but overseen by a community commission very similar to the Portland Children's Levy that's been successfully implemented for years and was just recently passed again by Portland voters this past May, to feed into some projects related to weatherization, clean energy for low-income people, green jobs training, locally supported agriculture and green infrastructure, and other projects that are innovative that help to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and promote equity and justice for those living on the front lines of climate change.
So it's very clear the goal of this initiative to provide these amenities for low-income people, but it's also supposed to be promoting jobs. So how does that work?
So a big portion of the Portland Clean Energy Fund, it's not only, you know, providing funding for weatherization or energy efficiency. There's a huge portion where we, I'm going to have to reference this. There's a category where it has to invest in job training, apprenticeship, contractor support for women, minority-owned businesses. So there's a key component of job training and ensuring organizations and community members that have been underserved by the economy or left out of the clean energy economy can start to grow there. Currently, we looked back recently, and we have one minority-owned solar company in the state of Oregon. And this is a state and a city known for its environmental values and its progressiveness, but we've locked out a section of our population. You know, even in Multnomah County or in the state of Oregon, over a quarter of our children are children of color, right? Our students represent over 50% of students of color in Multnomah County. So we're leaving out our communities from this growing economy, and this is where we're moving.
Well, I'm thinking about all these signs, lawn signs that have flourished since Trump became president about, you know, we embrace all of our neighbors and all, you know, pleas for diversity and, you know, Black Lives Matters. And I mean, and they're all over my neighborhood, which is predominantly a white neighborhood. How would this initiative maybe make some connection between these lawn signs and actually taking action?
Yeah, this initiative is an opportunity to say yes. You know, so often these days in this Trump era, we have to say no to these horrible policies that are being passed at the federal level that are causing great instability throughout our communities of color and immigrant and refugee communities. And this is an opportunity for folks to, you know, put their, I guess, their signature where their mouth is and their vote where their mouth is come November to stand for stability for our communities who have historically been placed in unstable positions, you know, for the past 500 plus years.
So I'm wondering, what were some of the things that motivated the organizers of this initiative? Because Portland is such a great, sustainable, liberal city. What made you feel like you needed to put this fund initiative on the ballot? And I'm also wondering, who initiated mm-hmm. this initiative?
Yeah, so we've been working on this for over 2.5 years, maybe 3 years now. So it's, I think, first and foremost, why I find it most exciting. This is the first environmental ballot initiative led by, designed by organizations of color in the state's history. So it's an incredible opportunity to stake ourselves as and demonstrate that we are key environmental players in the region and that our communities deserve these investments too. So, you know, the original the steering committee members and original founders of this are, you know, the Coalition of Communities of Color, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, the Native American Youth and Family Center, VEDDE, NAACP Portland chapter, and we partnered with some key grassroots environmental organizations, including 350 PDX, the Sierra Club Oregon chapter, Audubon Society of Portland, and Physicians for Social Responsibility. And our intent was getting to the core of environmental justice, that we are both protecting our communities from harm, we are providing benefit beyond the status quo, and more importantly, we're designing and planning this initiative by organizations of color that serve low-income communities and communities of color.
I just want to, as full disclosure, the reason why you guys are on is I got an email from Jasmine Zimmerstucky with Columbia Riverkeeper, and she said, you need to cover the Portland Clean Energy Fund, and here's the contact. And it basically, she hooked me up with Damon, and then you guys came on. So I thought, I mean, I am actually very thrilled by the three organizations you mentioned in particular, 350, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Audubon, and also Columbia Riverkeeper. I'm not sure how officially they're involved, but that those four environmental groups, I feel, have been like really doing, I mean, really stepping up and appreciating their need to diversify and doing the outreach and making the kind of connections. And the other thing I want to say is that every action I go to now, that when before we start with the first speaker, there's an acknowledgement of which indigenous land we're on. And to me, it's a real eye-opener. And so I just wanted to get a response from you guys about those two things.
Well, and I was going to jump onto what Maggie had shared about why I'm excited about this initiative specifically, you know, speaking from my experience, lived and worked experience within the Portland urban Indian community, you know, that our community members are deeply connected, you know, in our DNA to the land and its resources. We come from many different tribes and nations. We've got representation of over 380 tribes throughout the Portland metro area of our population of over 70,000. And we've come to Portland for a variety of reasons, but we all have an inherent ancestral connection to land, whether that's here or whether it's elsewhere where our tribes come from. As a member of the Tlingit tribe from Southeast Alaska, I feel a deep connection to this land as Salmon Nation. And I want to help to protect the treaty resources and the rights of those that have lived on this land since time immemorial. I know that as a member of the Tlingit tribe, you know, I'm a visitor to this land of the Chinook peoples. So I feel like that's a really key connection that grounds me and motivates me to be a part of this Portland Clean Energy Fund, because we have to do our part within the urban area to help make sure that we're helping to promote the vision of the tribes, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz, Grand Ronde, Warm Springs, the many others that have called this place home permanently or seasonally, to make sure that they continue to have those resources available for the next seven generations.
And do you feel like this effort on the part of environmental groups to acknowledge whose lands these are, does that coming across to you is genuine, and that it's actually a different mindset than where things were at a few years ago?
I'm really excited to see even in three plus years I've been at the coalition, I'm excited to see the progress by our environmental organizations and environmental partners in terms of centering equity within initiatives, but also in conversations. I think there's been a lot of progress. Of course, we have a lot of progress to make still, which, you know, PSF would be one of them. So I think with, you know, Audubon, PSR, 350 PDX, I think there was a clear recognition, again, that, when it comes to campaign time, there's often, very good, intentions about integrating organizations and communities of color and more diverse stakeholders into ballot measure campaigns, into fights against coal, for example. But campaigns are busy, they're intense, and often, like environmental investments, our communities get left out. And I think this is finally the opportunity that environmental organizations have, a number of environmental organizations have been looking for, and want to put forward and ensure that we're protecting our planet, but we're centering communities of color.
Well, actually, my impression of watching the movements, the fossil fuel replacement movement, has been that it's really been led by the tribes. And I see a lot more acknowledgement of that amongst the majority white environmental groups that have, for the most part, come on after the tribes kicked it off. And I've been spending a lot of time in Tacoma working with the people who are fighting the LNG up there. And the Puyallups are like, if it weren't for them, there'd be no movement. And there's a great acknowledgement of that and appreciation of that on part of all the other people involved. I think that's been really visible, but the Latino and the African-American component hasn't been as visible, at least from my eyes from the outside. And I'm wondering how is that being brought along? And I know that, well, there's Joanne Hardesty, who used to be sitting right here, who has been really an intersectional person in terms of working with communities of color and working with the environmental movement and many other movements. But I just wonder if you see that there are other instances where there has been a very strong environmental component in the work that these other groups have been doing.
I think I'd like to flip that. I think there's a misconception that our organizations don't care about the environment. But I think environmentalists and the environmental movement more generally has very narrowly defined what the environment is. It's often divorced from people, divorced from the economy, and divorced particularly from, I mean, the origins of the environmental movement are very racist. And you know, with environmental justice, we define environment as where you live, where you work, where you play, practice spirituality, go to school. It's an urban environment. And we have a plethora of examples here in Oregon, across the United States, of cross-cultural communities, culturally specific communities fighting against those waste incinerators, fighting against diesel within our trucks that disproportionately drive past our houses, fighting against lead in our drinking water. I think we see it everywhere. It's this narrow definition of environmentalism that has excluded so many communities.
Well, the whole idea that environmentalism is an urban issue as well as something where you're saving trees or you're stopping mines, I guess, brings it home again.
Yeah, and I would also just share that, you know, we have partnerships with many amazing organizations that are working on environmental issues, like the Portland African American Leadership Forum and Africa House through their Afroecology movement, as well as the Mudbone Grown Farm, where we're seeing our Black communities self-determining this reconnection to the land, which has historically had some, you know, very harmful, you know, histories associated with that. So, you know, this self-determined movement to reconnect with land and to build a self-determined environmental movement has been really powerful within our Black communities. Also, you know, the VOS Day Laborers Center had recently done a study in partnership with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about how to incorporate climate justice within their work, because, you know, we know that day laborers are on the front lines in the event of a disaster like Hurricane Katrina, which we saw. So we've been building this cross-cultural movement amongst our organizations and communities, which has been really powerful to see what climate justice and environment movement building looks like.
And I think another thing is not that our organizations need to be brought along. We've been doing this work. Our communities have been doing this work. We haven't been funded. We did some research a few years ago, the Coalition of Communities of Color, in partnership with the National, Responsible Philanthropy. And it really showed the warped and woeful underfunding of organizations of color, organizations that serve low-income communities to do environmental work. Whereas we see maybe 5% of environmental, and this is a few years old, but hasn't changed significantly. Whereas we see about 5%, maybe 5% of all environmental funding going to organizations that work with low-income people and people of color. Public philanthropy is even lower. So it's not that we don't want to work on these issues. We've never been provided the opportunity to sit at the table, to build up staff, to buy supplies. And it goes back to which organizations, which institutions, which people and communities have had access to capital, have had access to finance. And there's been a deliberate exclusion of people and organizations of color.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Maggie Talmadge and Carrie Waters, two leaders within the campaign to put the Portland Clean Energy Fund on the city ballot this November. So to follow up on what you just said, Maggie, how is this fund going to address the very things you just mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's one step in closing this green divide that I mentioned earlier between who receives environmental investments, who is able to access and build companies based on sustainability values. It will, again, invest in energy efficiency, weatherization, sustainable agriculture, job training, apprenticeships, contractor support, specifically looking first and foremost about who has been left out, communities of color, chronically underemployed, women, individuals with disabilities, and it'll generate $30 million a year for projects and nonprofit organizations that demonstrate a history of serving underserved communities.
And also, you know, we know that the funds are there. You know, as we were talking about before, billionaire corporations can and should pay their fair share. This is a first step towards that. And, you know, we're increasingly hearing about the ways that mega corporations in Oregon are hiding their profits, such as by taking advantage of the new tax haven regulation weakening from the latest legislative session in Salem. And Portland Clean Energy Fund will ensure that these billion-dollar retailers invest the start of their fair share. I'm not going to say their fair share, but it's a start in the well-being of our city.
How much would they be paying?
That have been underserved and overlooked for far too long. Let's see. So it would be 1% of their in Portland revenue if they make over $500,000 within the city of Portland.
And over $1 billion nationally, which is key.
Okay, so it's like I'm thinking about when with the initiative to tax corporations in Oregon mm-hmm. that was fought by a lot of companies that was a little surprising, like Powell's Books. So Powell's Books wouldn't be part of this tax because they don't have $1 billion in national
Correct.
Revenue.
Correct. Yeah, and this was a very deliberate decision of who would be subject to this 1% increase in the business license fee. So we wanted to target retail corporations for a few reasons, right? So they're not accounting for greenhouse gas emissions and unsustainable practices within their supply chain. Two, retail corporations cannot easily leave Portland. They want to sell goods to Portland residents. We're not going to see the Apple store get up and leave because they want to sell us iPads. We haven't seen any increase. We don't have evidence for increases to consumers. If we compare Oregon and California, California has vastly higher energy and water rates than Oregon. But the prices for retail goods are equivalent. So we were deliberate about those corporations that were chosen, and we deliberately exempt groceries, deliberately exempt healthcare services and medicine, utilities, co-ops, credit unions. So we want to make sure that this truly is something that large retail corporations can pay their fair share.
It sounds like you learned a lot of lessons from that corporate tax, because I think it did tax pharmaceuticals and food and a few other things. Mm-hmm. Does the business have to have a physical presence, or can you tax Amazon?
They would have to have a physical presence within the city of Portland. However, the city of Portland does determine what that footprint is.
Well, actually, Amazon owns Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. But Whole Foods is a grocery, so I'm not mm-hmm. sure how that would work. But
right. It wouldn't be focused on revenue unless there's non-grocery goods being sold. And I also want to make sure that we mention that 1 year ago this month, the city of Portland and Multnomah County passed landmark resolutions committing our community to 100% clean energy sector-wide by 2050. And those resolutions stipulate that 10% of that energy should be community generated by 2050.
And I should mention, many organizations pushed that target within those resolutions. So we're not new to this. We've been working at the state and local level in order to open up the clean energy economy for our communities.
Well, it sounds to me like, I mean, those goals, we've been hearing about these goals, and these are all the goals of the Paris Climate Accord, mm-hmm. and they don't make any sense unless there's actual action. So mm-hmm. do you feel like this initiative is the way towards making these goals a reality by 2050, which is, it's only 32 years mm-hmm. from now?
Yes, absolutely. We have a tangible way to help achieve these goals, through all of the projects that we mentioned, the types of projects that would be eligible for Portland Clean Energy Fund funding, And this measure will help us to reach these goals and provide a model for other cities to do the same. I think that's what's very exciting to me and to our group of steering committee members, all of the 175 diverse organizations that have endorsed. I'll also mention, if anyone wants to endorse the initiative who's listening, you can do so at portlandcleanenergyfund.com. And it's also what's, I think, the most scary to some of these businesses that have the potential to be impacted by this surcharge, because if it happens in Portland, it can start to happen across our nation.
So, well, you're not on the ballot yet, but do you expect there's going to be millions of dollars being funneled into the campaign to try to defeat it?
We will definitely have opposition, but I think the fortunate thing is Portlanders, by and far, they voted in support of that corporate tax you mentioned earlier, overwhelmingly so. Portlanders want to help be the solution to climate change and inequality. They want corporations to pay their fair share, and they want to do it together. So I have full confidence that Portland voters will see through the lies of opposition.
Even the gentrifiers in Portland. Well, actually, this is another one thing I wonder about is, how much support are you getting from the city and the county?
So I think, you know, I'm actually going to go back. So I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and I was raised with a value called Gadugi, which means to come together for the betterment of the community. And I think we're starting to see that, right? We're starting to see that across public partners. We're starting to see that across environmental partners, labor unions, and I think the Portland Clean Energy Fund is one of those examples of Gadugi. We are coming together to create a future, and we're creating complementary policies to move us forward.
So do you get, I mean, I think it's very exciting that this initiative has been initiated, conceived, worked on, propelled into this current state by communities of color, and that it's not something that's been coming beneficently handed down from the city fathers or whatever. But I am wondering about the reality of Portlanders really coming in an organizational way, in a governmental way, besides individual supporting. Do you feel like when this goes on the ballot, are you hopeful that there'll be some kind of support for this initiative on the part of city and county officials?
I do. You know, it's a progressive mechanism. I consistently hear our decision makers talk about community values, centering equity. And if those values hold true, they're supportive. We have strong partnerships across with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, with Multnomah County, with the city, and we're working on a number of initiatives. So I see this is only as a complementary mechanism for our city and county officials to meet their goals, too.
Well, I'm hoping we'll see the turnaround like that Charlie Hales took around oil issues. I mean, well, he was against oil. He just was supporting liquid propane. But, you know, that he went from being a big booster of Pembina Terminal for liquid propane to leading in the infrastructure ban on fossil fuel. So, I mean, people mm-hmm. can change, too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have... Go ahead. Go ahead. And we have... our endorser list also includes elected officials. So this isn't... Again, this is the widest range of organizations I've seen on a ballot.
So in the last couple moments that we have, how can people get involved?
I was just about to share that, you know, it's been amazing seeing the outpouring of support from hundreds of Portlanders, as well as folks who might live just outside Portland boundaries but are willing to help collect signatures. We need to collect 35,000 valid signatures by July 6th. We have had an amazing outpouring of support from volunteers, but we still need support from folks throughout the city to help gather signatures.
So how do they get
state?
How do they get in touch with you?
So PortlandCleanEnergyFund.com is the first place to check us out. We're also on Facebook, Portland Clean Energy Fund, as well as Instagram and Twitter. And we have some regular gatherings, for example, at the Sierra Club on Southeast 18th and Ankeny from 5 to 7 every Monday. That's today. You can stop by for a short training on how to collect signatures, and it's the point of location for return of those signatures on a weekly basis.
And I know you can see signature gatherers probably at every farmer's market every day of the week here in Portland. I see my old friend Jim at the Moreland Farmer's Market every week gathering signatures. So thank you, Jim.
Yeah, and so you can stop by the campaign office at Sierra Club anytime. We'd love you to gather signatures. We'd love for you to go on and endorse the campaign and donate. We have a crowdfund campaign that is, we're trying to raise $30,000. I think we're closing in the next couple of weeks. So you can also go to the PortlandCleanEnergyFund.com to donate and help support this community-led effort.
And we'll have that link on our website here on Locus Focus, which, by the way, our website is back and working.
Hooray.
Well, I want to thank you guys very much for joining us. It's very interesting to talk about this, and I'd like to have you on again to talk about further issues. Maybe we can solve the housing crisis.
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, today we've been talking with Carrie Waters and Maggie Talmadge, who are two leaders within the campaign to put the Portland Clean Energy Fund on the city ballot this November, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking with Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute about how Washington State is now in the tar sands crosshairs. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to get with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening. Jack.